T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
That is exactly what I needed to hear.
Thank God someone here knows what they're talking about.
That's us. That's right. Gotta love this American ride.
All right, you need to take the time and get the full picture.
I love the ladies. I mean, they rip my engine, but they don't belong in the newsroom.
It is Anchor Man, not Anchor Lady.
What do you want from me? I'm not a Mary the sweetheart.
Goodness sake, Beth, keep your voice down. Your father's listening to the radio.
I'm not a Mary the sweetheart.
This is the Annie Fry Show.
In fact, it is the Annie Fry Show. John Hancock sitting in for Annie. This is my last day here. Wiggy is aboard. Wiggy, how are you doing there, brother?
Doing good. Doing good.
And, of course, Jake behind the what do you call that thing? The board.
Most people call it the board, I call it the panel of responsibility.
Oh, very, very nice.
First time I ever heard that term.
I just made it up because I couldn't think of anything better.
Well, that was just fine. You know, one of the great things about living life is that you get to meet some really awesome people along the way. And one such really awesome person that I've been privileged to get to know a little bit is one of the voices of the St. Louis Cardinals. He was a crafty left-hander back when I was in high school. But he is most noteworthy in my mind for the work he's done with the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. I'm speaking, of course, about number 49, the left-hander, and now one of the voices of the Cardinals, Rick Horton, is joining us. Rick, how are you, brother?
I'm doing great, John, and I'm still reacting to that you being in high school comment that you just made there. But great to visit with you, and you know, I really do appreciate your friendship and certainly your support of FCA over the years.
Yeah, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, for folks that don't aren't familiar with it, is a phenomenal organization, and you've been involved with them for how long? How did your involvement start, and what's your passion for the organization?
Well, you know, I was actually involved in it. I was asked to go to an FCA meeting when I was an athlete at Virginia, and someone asked me to go to a meeting, and I didn't quite understand what's going on. But the reality was, I found some people that I was like-minded with, where, you know, they cared about doing the right thing. They cared about playing sports in a godly way, coaching in a godly way, and that has continued to be my passion and my reason for loving the work of FCA. I served as the director of St. Louis FCA for over 20 years, and still involved with them in a big way. And I just I love the work of FCA. I just think, you know, coaches, and one of the things we love to say, John, is coaches have so much opportunity to influence, and we want to influence the influencers. And that's kind of the main thrust of what we do, is to try to get them to understand this great role they have to influence athletes, not just for what happens on the field, but, you know, for their growth personally, spiritually, emotionally, relationally, you name it. But I just love the way the organization connects people. And you think, John, about what's gone on over the last couple of years, we need more connection, not less.
Yeah, you know, my athletic prowess is, well, it wasn't much. but it was still, for me, it was a coach in middle school that first presented the gospel to me, and I'm not even an athlete. So those coaches do have such a profound effect, and most of them appreciate that fact as well, don't they?
I think they do. I think they understand that it's, they're in it, they're going to get some abuse along the way because, people care about winning and losing. maybe too much. And of course, winning and losing is important. If you're trying to do something, you should do it the best you can. But at the end of whatever competition you're in, whether it's the Olympics or Cardinal baseball or high school softball or high school volleyball, you know, when you're at the end of that, you know, you still you have to handle it in a godly way, in a good relational way with others. And, you know, otherwise you have bitterness and discord and all that stuff. And honestly, you know, I love good sportsmanship. That has always been kind of a thing that I just love to see. I mean, I just love to see displays of good sportsmanship. But even beyond that, when somebody's faith is intertwined with what they do athletically, again, even winning or losing, that to me just resonates.
Rick Horton on the phone with us. This is Ryan Wiggins, Rick. So when I was in high school in the 90s, I think I barely snuck into things like FCA because I was barely on any teams. I ended up on a golf team and got a letter and was able to sneak on. So, but since then, having FCA involved with schools, the culture has changed. Have you had any problems with, you know, being involved with public education in any ways?
It's a great question, Ryan. And you know, that's one of the great things about it is, you know, in some sense, we're all barely making it. I was barely a Cardinal for many years, but I loved being barely a Cardinal. But it's, you know, the idea is if you love sports and you're interested in sports, FCA is still a good place for a high school or college student. The answer is actually we really haven't had a lot of disconnect. Now some of the athletes and coaches may feel that from administration, but the point is, you know, our FCA groups are protected by equal access laws, and really, you know, if students want FCA, you know, you're kind of allowed to have it. So most of our schools have not had kind of administrative or legal challenges because it's within the rights of students to meet and discuss their faith. And, you know, we still are protected by, you know, the right to religious freedom. So that's still happening. It may be culturally a challenge for some athletes and coaches to realize that they may be against the grain and, you know, the proverbial salmon swimming upstream that's against the flow of our cultural tide.
Sure,
but,
sure.
You know, part of what we want to do is encourage them to be strong in that.
Yeah. So if we got some parents out there who have kids in school and they want to learn more about what FCA has to offer, I'm sure there's a place they can go online.
There is stlfca.org is our website, and all the information about our camps and our huddles are our big thing that are school-based groups that students lead. The students lead and discuss issues relating to the athletic life with each other, and we think peer influence matters. So if you're a parent and you want your young daughter or son to have an experience around other people that are like-minded or you want to have kind of the peer influence, and FCA is the perfect place, you know, on a campus setting. And so stlfca.org is where you can go. And again, huddles, camps, we do a lot with coaches as well.
Well, it's just a phenomenal organization, and I'm glad to have you on to talk about it. Can't have you on, Rick Horton, without talking a little Cardinal baseball.
Of course.
So Cardinals are playing the Guardians up in Cleveland
yeah.
for a couple of days. This club has been a little bit exasperating. You see these glimpses of what could be, you know, that
yeah.
last game in Cincinnati where they put a bunch of runs on the board. And then it seems like the bats go silent. The pitching is inconsistent. Of course, dealing with injuries. What do you make of this ball club?
Well, you know, I think exasperating is a good word, and the Cardinals go into play today right at 500. But, of course, if you're a fan of Cardinal baseball, you hope for more. And I'm actually in Cleveland with the team. I'm back traveling with them again, guys, and I'm just so thankful for that because I feel like, you know, on our radio broadcast, we can connect a lot better and see guys and connect with coaches and the manager and all that. And it's just, you know, what I feel is still a continued optimism. And oddly, you know, I think the optimism is based on the fact that, you know, you haven't had – and I think the main crux of the problem is you have not had Jack Flaherty and Miles Mikolas for a long time. You're 1-2 starters. So Wainwright has moved into the number one guy. And, you know, we all love Adam Wainwright. But, you know, at some point we thought going into spring training, he'd be the fifth starter, for goodness sakes. And now he's the number one guy. And Kim's probably number two. By the way, both those guys throwing here in Cleveland the next 2 days. So that's good news against, you know, what can be a pretty good Indians lineup. But, you know, we've just put a lot of young guys maybe a little out over their skis a little bit too much in terms of young pitchers getting starts like Oviedo, And, you know, not that, you know, you don't see the promise in him, but probably not ready to be your, you know, number three starter in a rotation. And so, you know, I think, you know, the clear point here is we need the big guns back.
We're talking with Rick Horton here on the Annie Fry Show. The trade deadline is, I think, Friday, right?
Yeah, it's the 31st, if that's Friday. You know, in baseball, it's funny. I get back into the broadcasting thing, and I don't know what any day. I don't know what day it is.
Oh, I know.
Back like I was playing again. If you told me it was Monday or Friday, I'd agree with you. I just have no idea.
Well, I think it is Friday, as far as I'm seeing here.
Saturday.
Okay. Well, fine, John.
Well, I'm just trying to be helpful over here.
Well, the question, of course, you know, what do you see happening? Are the Cardinals buyers, sellers, are they going to do anything, just kind of waiting for guys to come back from the injured list or what?
I think it's going to be a wait thing, and I know that's going to frustrate some people, but just the weird thing about this Cardinal team is you don't really want to mess. The offense has been better. You don't want to mess with our young outfielders. They're starting to gel, and so it's like, well, you don't want to trade Tyler O'Neill to somebody just to get a pitcher that, you know, helps you, I mean, or even trade Nolan Gorman or Mason Wynn or Jordan Walker, some of your young, talented, lower A guys, in the case of Walker and Wynn, you just don't want to do that either, because that's mortgaging your future. So you kind of have the pieces. They're just not quite gelling. And so if you dismantle those pieces, you might actually go backwards. So I have a feeling the Cardinals are going to stand pat and hope that Flaherty and Michaelis kind of provide a boost. And both guys expected to be back in a couple of weeks. You know, I know that's not the news everybody wants to hear. You want to make a big splash, and maybe they make a deal and do something. But right now you're just trying to do patchwork starting pitching until those big guys get back.
Yeah, a couple of guys on this team that I find fascinating. Harrison Bader, who's having clearly his best season yet, and Paul DeJong, who's having his worst season yet.
Yeah.
What do we have in these two guys? Is the reality somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, it always is. There's always an ebb and flow in this, but I start with Bader because I had a visiting broadcaster tell me, your team is better with Bader because he energizes everybody else around him because of his, you know, the way he plays with flair and emotion and passion. And I can't disagree with that. I mean, I think since Bader's been back in center, you see more emotion and passion in both Carlson and O'Neill in the outfield corners. And I think the outfielders are great. And honestly, without Bader, you've got a lot of guys that kind of are good players, but, you know, like DeJong and Goldschmidt and Edmund, they're just not going to be, you know, kind of high energy play. I'm not saying they're not great, good players, really good players, but they're not kind of the emotional players. And I think Bader brings that, and I want to say flair to this team that is needed. So he, and of course the defense is extraordinary. Paul DeJong is, you know, I'm a big fan of Paul DeJong, but I see that he's, you know, he's got to figure it out. He's got to figure out how to be more consistent. You know, when he goes on a tear, he can really hurt you. He can definitely hurt you with the big fly, but you know, you can't play shortstop every day and bat 200. He knows that. And you know, the hope is that he gets back to that form that he had, you know, a couple of years ago. He was second in the Rookie of the Year balloting, for goodness sakes, his rookie year of the big leagues, and hit 30 home runs in 2018. So this guy certainly can do it. He just got to figure out a way to do it more consistently.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And, you know, we've got something in Edmundo Sosa, too, that, you know, an interesting ball player, and he almost didn't make the roster coming out. He had a bad spring.
But
he's got a real upside.
He didn't make the had to make the team or get sent out. I mean, he was at the last straw stage, and he hit a home run his last day of spring training. They'd already decided he was going to make the team. He hit a home run, and the guy was in absolute tears over. I mean, he was like so excited to be a Cardinal, and that energy has pushed him forward. I think he's fun to watch. I mean, he's a real player. You know, Cardinals need to have effective players off of their bench, and whether that's Sosa playing off the bench or playing every once in a while, whatever it is, you know, our bench has been full of young players that are untested. We are the last in the National League in pinch hitting. I mean, we're last, we're dead last. And when you're a young player, it's hard to pinch hit without playing often enough. So that's the challenge. If you're going to play young players on your bench, you got to keep them sharp somehow. And, you know, that's been a challenge with Sosa. But I honestly, when he's played, especially at home, the Cardinals have won.
Indeed they have, and we hope they do some winning in Cleveland. I'm glad you're there, Rick Horton, and we'll be tuned in and listening to the broadcast this evening and, I guess, tomorrow afternoon as well.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here in Cleveland. Visited the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame yesterday, but now more importantly going to watch the Cardinals win a couple of games. So good to be with you guys.
All right, thanks so much. That's Rick Horton, ladies and gentlemen. When we come back, a reporter with the Cranes Detroit business, Chad Livengood, used to be here in Missouri. He's covered the Detroit bankruptcy and how they've come out of it, and that's going to be a fascinating conversation.
Wait, his last name is Livengood?
Livengood.
Oh, I thought it was Livengood. I'm like, that's an awesome last name. Well, I'm Chad Livengood.
We'll clarify that when we come back. That was Jake, by the way. Wiggy's right over here. I'm John Hancock, in for Annie Fry on 97.1 FM Talk.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with 3 friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.
Carry on my wayward son. There'll be Kansas. Peace when you
this
are
is good.
Done.
You know, the violinist of Kansas passed away.
I did hear about that.
Yeah, really great guy, great musician. Well, a city that's dealing with crime problems, lots of drugs, declining property values, corruption in government. Such a city could be said of, well, you could say that of St. Louis. But there is such a city to the north of St. Louis that has gone through a true resurgence, and they've done it through going bankrupt. And I'm talking about the city of Detroit, Michigan. And there's a reporter. He's with Cranes Detroit Business. He's senior reporter there. He used to cover state politics here in Missouri 15, 16 years ago, and he's been in Michigan ever since. Chad Livengood joins us. Chad, how are you, partner?
Hey, John. Good to talk with you.
Yeah, It's been years, and I thought of you. We got to talking yesterday on the show about St. Louis, and, of course, we're flush with all this federal money, as everybody is right now. But St. Louis, the finances, just the structure of the government is such that I do think it could be in the future of St. Louis to go through something like what happened to Detroit. So let's start at the beginning. Detroit ended up, what happened?
So Detroit, let's just go back to 1950. Detroit was the fifth, sixth largest city in the country, 2 million residents. It had been known as the Arsenal Democracy, pumped out a lot of planes and tanks and jeeps and engines that helped support the war effort. And it obviously had grown grown the automotive industry. The birthplace of Ford Motor Company, General Motors, born in Flint, eventually moved to Detroit, the Chrysler Corporation, and then literally dozens of other auto companies that eventually got gobbled up by one of those three companies or went out of business, like Packard Plant and Company and such. So Detroit had immense wealth, was kind of referred to as the Paris of the West, but then the mid-century dynamic of race relations in this country and the building of the suburbs post-war really led a lot of whites, particularly, to leave the city and move out into the suburbs. The city basically got overbuilt. The auto plants that they built were not designed to. They were built for building Model A's and Packard cars, and they were not built for your modern auto plants like you have in Wentzville. And so they needed more space to build bigger car plants that were single floors. They didn't have that space in Detroit, so they moved to Warren. They moved to Livonia. They moved downriver Detroit. Out into the suburbs, auto plants started popping up, and people started moving out to the suburbs to get closer to those jobs. Fast forward into the 80s and 90s, the city of Detroit lost a million people in the 80s and 90s, and then they lost another 300,000 people in the early 2000s, and by the 2010 census, they were down to less than 700,000 people in the city of Detroit. Wayne County itself, the main county of where Detroit is, didn't really change population, though. And really, Michigan in general, we've been stagnant in population since 1970. We've basically been stuck at 10 million people, and 4 million of them of which live in southeast Michigan, Metro Detroit. So what led to Detroit's bankruptcy was both, the housing values, the depressed property values that came out of the Great Recession significantly just sank the city's finances. And then the city got into a whole host of bad financial deals. They had a corrupt mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, who just got freed by Donald Trump, as many people know, on his last day in office. And by the way, Kwame Kilpatrick, the former mayor, just got remarried last weekend, and so it's kind of a big news event here in Detroit. And he's now going into the seminary, become a preacher. So he's been reformed in the pen after about 7 years for his corruption. But all this culminated with the bankruptcy Detroit, which was filed July 18th, 2013. So I covered it for the Detroit News for about a year and a half. It was one of the more wilder stories you could have covered at the time, but it was immense. The city came in with about $17 billion of debt, and it ranged from pensions to unfunded healthcare liabilities to a whole host of basically credit card use of running the city for several years during the Kilpatrick years and on. And they emerged, they basically shed about $10 billion of it. And what that's done for Detroit is it freed up over 5-6 year period, about $1.5 billion just to spend on reinvesting in services. John, we had 50-minute response rates for ambulances in the city of Detroit. People were literally dying at home because they could not, the fire department or the ambulance department, EMS, could not get to your house fast enough. If you were not in imminent danger or being robbed, good luck getting an officer to your house as well. And so a lot has changed. That response rate is now 7 minutes or less. It's under the national average. And that's been a kind of a combination of both having the money to spend on resources for people, and a lot of it has to do with leadership, too. You know, Mayor Mike Duggan has been the mayor of Detroit now. He is almost to the end of his eighth year. He faces re-election this fall, and you have to give him some major credit. A lot of it started with the bankruptcy and the state managing the city's finances and taking the city through bankruptcy, which was, as you might imagine, a monumental task, and it was highly controversial at the time.
So, Chad, you're in Detroit, and this is Ryan Wiggins, by the way. You've been here in Missouri. What parallels do you see that could happen to St. Louis? Because we're sitting here downtown right now looking out our window and just seeing all of the, we're seeing issues, but we also see statistics that don't look good. They're all going in the wrong direction. What could happen as far as the state possibly taking over the city, and how does that happen?
Well, it kind of depends on how the legislature allows it. Michigan had to go through quite a long road to get to the state takeover of the city. It started actually under John Engler, the Republican, longtime Republican governor of the 90s. They passed an emergency financial manager law that allowed the state to intervene when a city was basically insolvent or a school district was insolvent. At the time, they were taking on the schools in Detroit, and John Engler installed basically an emergency manager, and they installed a new school board. It basically suspended democracy. I mean, it was highly controversial. And then Governor Jennifer Granholm, who's now the energy secretary under the Biden administration, she continued that, but maybe less aggressive. Less aggressive is probably being charitable. And then when Rick Snyder, Republican governor elected in 2010, a CPA by training, came in, he started looking at just how dysfunctional and how broke Detroit and Flint and a few other cities were. And so he got a lot aggressive. They got a stronger emergency manager law that gave the emergency manager the ability to impair contracts and essentially rewrite union contracts, cut benefits, and also seek bankruptcy. Through a long fight, the AFSCME, the American Federation of State Municipal Employees Unions, I'm sure that you have some AFSCME unions in St. Louis, they fought him, and they got the law repealed. And apologies, south side, there's a motorcycle. And they get the law repealed, and ultimately they were able to get the law repealed. The legislature turned around and had to go back and pass a new emergency manager law. But this time they gave the governor the authorization to allow for bankruptcy. And municipal bankruptcy is really rare. There's only been a dozen of them or so in the country in history of the bankruptcy code, which is about 90 years old now. And so they had that was what the sort of impetus to allow for Detroit to file for bankruptcy. And basically the governor sent in an emergency manager who essentially sidelined the mayor and the city council and became the government, which extraordinarily rare. And for anybody who's sort of an observer of democracy, not very democratic, actually. I mean, it just there was no vote. The emergency manager essentially was king, and he was able to execute all the deals that made the bankruptcy happen.
Our guest is Chad Livengood. He's a senior reporter with Crain's Detroit Business, joining us from Detroit, Michigan. And you know, Detroit has had a true rebound for the first time in decades, and have they managed the crime problem better in Detroit of late than it had been in the 80s and 90s?
Of late, yes. There's definitely a better handle on it, but part of it is there's a whole host of reasons, but part of it is there's fewer people to police. I mean, there are less than 700,000 people to police. We haven't really gained any population. There's still middle-class blacks leaving the city for better schools, better opportunity, go to the suburbs. What's happening right now is like whites are moving back in from the suburbs, like millennials are moving in. Some of it's because they got jobs. Quicken Loans, now called Rocket Companies, founded by Dan Gilbert, the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers. They've been sort of instrumental in the revitalization of Detroit downtown. They got 17,000 employees, and it's starting to creep out in the neighborhoods, but it's very, very spotty. There's also quite a bit of gentrification in some neighborhoods going on. So it's not a very equal and even comeback in the city. And it really has been a lot of things have kind of gotten upended in the last 18 months with the pandemic. And so we're not quite sure what that's going to look like post pandemic. Do people actually return to the office? Does it really continue to bring more people back downtown? It's kind of an open question, but the bankruptcy certainly brought some certainty to city government, and brought investment and into the city that we haven't seen in decades. And people like Gilbert, who spent billions of dollars, now he's building a skyscraper, the first one in 30 years to be constructed in Detroit. And there's a lot more optimism. Ford Motor Company, which long ago left Detroit for the suburbs of Dearborn to the west of Detroit. They bought an old decrepit train station that everybody thought needed a wrecking ball. And the great-grandson of Henry Ford is now spending $700 million of company money to revitalize this, to build out an autonomous vehicle development center to try to basically compete with Silicon Valley's of and other Boston and other cities that are attracting, you know, highly educated, talented tech workers, because the motor companies are becoming more tech companies and more focused on that as we get closer and closer to autonomous vehicles, right, sort of becoming part of our life. They are essentially in competition with Google and Apple and Microsoft for the same great minds to help figure out how to basically make the robot car go.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's fascinating to look at the parallels between St. Louis and Detroit, especially the front end of the interview where you talked about the history and the declining populations. We're experiencing so much of that here. Chad Livengood, thank you so much for taking some time out, and I appreciated catching up with you earlier today on the phone, and I wish you the very best, my friend.
Hey, thanks for having me, John. Take care.
You bet. Really interesting stuff there, and, you know, a lot to consider about what could be a bright future for St. Louis,
yeah,
perhaps.
Just full of hypotheticals, but that are realities in other places. That's what's interesting about it, is that not that this has to happen here,
right,
but that similar things have happened elsewhere that could happen here, very, very well could happen here based on the financial situation of St. Louis.
Yep. Well, you never know. Well, are you a conservative? Or are you a liberal? Or are you a Republican? Or are you a Democrat? Well, we're going to talk about how the times they are a-changing. That's next on The Annie Fry Show, 97.1 FM Talk. That went quick. We're back already. Hey, it's John Hancock. It's The Annie Fry Show. Wiggy and I were having a chat earlier today, and he made a really interesting point about how our politics has changed in this country. And, you know, for so many years, we were divided liberal and conservative, and it's certainly still the case. But the parties were much more identified as liberal and conservative, and that's kind of changed. And I just thought your perspective on that was really good.
Well, I think it's happened in the last just couple of years. Even since Trump's been in office, because mm-hmm. I think in 2016, this was something that was just starting to percolate a little bit, but wasn't completely on the radar as much as it is now. But you and I have talked, John, you know, we're, I think, principled conservatives,
right,
as is Annie, as is a lot of people who talk here. And over the years, that's changed from being that you vote for people who are right in line with your policy positions to where in the last couple of years, and you would know a lot about this too, being a, you know, consultant and things to people, that it seems as if the electorate is now looking more at, are you an insider? Basically, are you part of the system, mm-hmm. or are you not? Because as a principled conservative, I used to look at your policy positions much more, and I still do. But more lately, I've found myself, and a lot of people I think fall in this category, where you look at somebody like Tulsi Gabbard, mm-hmm. and you say, you are not, 90% of your policies are not in line with my views. However, she very much seems to be somebody who's not part of the system. And so you sort of look on somebody like that kindly and say, oh, maybe she could be the vice president. Wait a minute, what are we talking about? She's not going to be a vice presidential candidate for Ron DeSantis or something. But you almost allow it because you're so willing to go against the system.
Yep.
And I think this may be the point of whatever I was sort of overall making, is that until we get rid of that system that's in place right now, really none of the policy decisions that we want to make are going to happen.
That's a really interesting and accurate observation, the sort of anti-establishment versus establishment, and both parties are dealing with it. I mean, you know, certainly the Trump phenomenon in the Republican Party was in part a reaction to the establishment of the Republican Party, clearly. And in what you're seeing on the left now, Democrats, you're having the AOCs and the Ilhan Omars of the world who are running against the establishment. I mean, AOC defeated the number three ranking Democrat in Congress in a primary,
mm-hmm.
Running as an anti-establishment candidate. And the seeds of this sentiment go way back. Well, they go back to forever. There's always been an anti-in element to our politics. And, you know, in recent years, you could look at the Ross Perot movement in the early 90s as a reaction against the establishment, clearly. And on the Republican side, we've gone through these the iterations from Pat Buchanan running against the system. Certainly the Ron Paul phenomenon in the early and mid-2000s was a reaction against the institutional candidates. And then along came Donald Trump, who really more successfully than anyone ever had ran against the established order of the day. And that's where we are now. And it's almost to seek office now, you're almost looking and recruiting candidates who have never held office before. And I cannot tell you the last time, because I run campaigns for a living. And it used to be any given cycle, you'd have a client or five clients where you would run on their experience, and the theme of the campaign would be, you know, put Joe's experience to work for you, or experience counts, experience matters, tested, experienced, you know, those kinds of thematics. I haven't used that thematic with a client in, I don't know, 6 years, because that is not a selling point for voters.
Well, I do think Trump changed it. And you're right, that anti-establishment thing's been there for a long, long time. But I don't think it was there even in 2016 yet, because as you recall, he was only getting like 35% of the vote.
Right, in a 17-member field.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, 65% of the vote was still going to people who would be maybe considered part of the system. It wasn't until he got in and really was so loud and public and put a spotlight on the swamp and these things that it became now in 2020, especially and beyond, that's the litmus test if you're on – especially on the right. I don't think that you can really win a national election unless you've proven that, A, you're not part of the system, and B, more importantly, because you can be a politician and still prove this to us somehow. You got to prove to us that you're not going to become a part of the system.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can show that what you've done so far has been rebelling against whatever that is, I call it the system, but people use different terms for swamp and deep state and all the other things. If you're not going to fall into that and fall in line with that for personal gain, then you can still have that credibility and still have a political background, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating. So we talked about this a little earlier. I expect 2022 to be a huge Republican year.
Yeah,
just historically, the party that's in the White House loses seats in the midterm. And with just a very few notable exceptions after 9/11, George Bush and the Republicans gained seats in Congress in 2002. But that's clearly the exception rather than the rule. So just the natural ebb and flow of politics means it's going to be good Republican year. You put on top of that the redistricted lines we talked about, that's going to skew and be beneficial to Republicans. And Republicans only need to flip four seats in the House to take a majority. So you could be looking at a 35-45 vote flip in the House, which would give the GOP, you know, a strong, solid majority. But then coming out of that, you're going to have the election of 2024. Donald Trump says he's going to run. I mean, he hasn't said, but he's given every indication that he's going to run. I think if he runs, he's the nominee. What do you think?
Yeah, I think he will be if he runs. I still, even though he's floating that idea out there to friends at cocktail parties and is getting out, I still think that's part of a strategy to keep him in the conversation for now. I still am not sure that he's going to run. But let me ask you this. Was 2020, as a strategist, when you look across the country, was 2020 the most strange election you've ever seen?
It was pretty bizarre because Republicans did well in the congressional races. And
right.
And we didn't take the bath in the Senate that so many people thought we were going to take. But, you know, you lose the White House. And so it was a very, very odd election. In that regard, and really, one of the phenomenon that Donald Trump has brought to our politics is he's really changed the makeup of the GOP electorate.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you bring these working class white voters into the fold in a substantial way, and I'm looking at I've seen exit polling data from 16 and 20 that of the trade unions, the folks that build cars and, you know, build buildings, Trump won. I mean, and mm-hmm. won solidly with that voter. And that's a voter that was a reliable Democrat voter for decades. So he fundamentally transformed the electorate. And I think you can make an argument that only a Donald Trump type figure could kind of cobble together the votes to win an electoral map. So that was one phenomenon, and some of the Republicans down the ballot, you know, have not quite caught up to Trump with that working class voter yet.
Mm-hmm.
But on the flip side of that, his erosion with particularly suburban women was profound. And so I think as I look at what happened in that election, I think Trump underperformed with suburban women who stuck around and still voted for a number of, you know, their U.S. senator and their member of Congress, although we did lose suburban seats in the U.S. House. So I think that it was strange because of the shifting nature of the GOP electorate.
Do you, okay, this is a tough question to ask because I'm trying to frame it right. Is it working class whites that have left the Democrat Party, or is it just the working class?
Well, it's primarily working class white voters, and but Trump performed better with African Americans than Republicans typically do,
mm-hmm.
and he performed better with Latinos than Republicans had done. While George Bush performed very well with the Latino vote, but Trump certainly performed better than Romney had, and better than McCain had before him. So those two things also did happen. I mean, we're still losing those two demographics by a lot, African-Americans and Latinos. But he did perform better with them. But the main inflow of votes that Donald Trump brought to the Republican Party was working class white voters.
And what we've seen from Joe Biden in 6 months and from Democrats for a few years now is that they seem to be doing things that don't help workers.
Yeah.
I mean, they help them stay home.
Right.
So they help people.
Well, I mean, look at the Keystone Pipeline. I mean,
yes.
You're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs there that they just, you know, punted.
Yeah. All trades. I mean, if you're
right.
a trade worker,
right.
you've got to see. I mean, the prices of lumber, for one, you know.
Yeah.
Not that that's something that Joe Biden issued an executive order. I want to raise the price of lumber. But all the things that he's doing are contributing to that. So it seems to me like that's not just a Donald Trump shift, that's a more permanent shift that's
could
happening.
Could well be. Democrats are going to have to figure that out if they're going to be able to elect national figures, because as they continue drifting to the left, and I'm talking about the socialist left, they're going to find that the votes aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may be able to elect an AOC and you know, in the Bronx, but that dog's not going to play. It's not going to hunt in a nationwide election. It's just not going to happen. And if that's who they start nominating, then I mean, the one thing about Biden, you know, he is what he is, but he was perceived as a moderate when he was running.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's not governing as a moderate. I get that, and you know, but he was perceived as a moderate. So it's going to be, the future's going to be fascinating, my friend.
As long as we make sure everybody's confident that their vote counts.
Indeed, indeed. Hey, we're going to check in with Mike Gonzalez from the Heritage Foundation about all of the stuff going on in Cuba. And later next hour, my buddy Michael Kelly's got a story. That today, this is the 10th anniversary of the Chuck Berry statue in the Del Mar Loop. He's got a great Chuck Berry story. He's going to join us at the end of the show. It's the Annie Fry Show. Wiggy is here. Jake is over there. We've got worms that we've talked about.
And
more
got worms
coming your way after this. 97.1.
Get more at 97.1talk.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s. And each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s?
It's better over here.
Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.